Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is by Letty Teague, The Optimal Time to Uncork. We'll follow that up with an article by Andy Kessler, There Are No Rules for Success. Then, The Future of AI Lies in Monkeys, Not Microchips, by Corey Miller. And then Tom Rosenblatt wrote, A Chatbot Can Be Part of Your Medical Team. And we'll follow that up with an article by Joe Queenan, No One Believes Your 10,000 Steps. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one, The Optimal Time to Uncork. How long do you wait between buying and opening a bottle of wine? I posed that question a few weeks ago and received a veritable torrent of interesting replies. The answers were sometimes amusing and often edifying, not unlike journal readers themselves. Though respondents' individual approaches were wonderfully idiosyncratic, I was able to identify several common ideas and strategies that sounded eminently sensible, not to mention practicable. Determine what you have and whether you want more. John Blondeau from Monterey, California, set the record for speed and efficiency. If Bondo is shopping at a wine store far from home and finds an interesting bottle, he will open and try it on the spot. I buy one bottle, take it to the car, and try it with crackers kept in the glove compartment for that purpose. If it's good, I go back in and buy a case. If he's buying the wine at a store near his house, he will drink it with dinner. He likes it, he returns and buys a case. Bondo noted that he hasn't done the parking lot pour since he and his wife moved to Monterey, where we have a well-stocked Total Wine a few minutes away. Many seem to share Bondo's buy a bottle, then buy a case practice, though none reported doing so with the same alacrity. Eugene Cassidy of Marshalltown, Iowa, as what he described as a trial bottle approach. He buys one bottle and tastes it, and if he likes it, he will return to the wine store pronto and buy many more, often the whole stock. Kevin Moser of Shenandoah Valley, Virginia, also opens the wine he buys as soon as possible, not only to see if he likes them, but also to determine the appropriate drinking window based on the characteristics of the wine. He recalled the Sauvignon Blanc from Glen Manor Vineyards in Virginia that needed a surprisingly long time to open up. Coatsworth Pitney of Richmond, Virginia, noted that the clientele of his local Costco is pretty sophisticated, which means the good bottles don't last long. Pitney tries to taste the wines he buys there quickly so he knows whether or not to return to the store for more. Although he hasn't found anything he truly loves lately, he liked the Pietelli Vineyard Malbec from Argentina well enough to return and buy more. Keep track of your stock. Some, like David Bastian of Spanish Fort, Alabama, reported an impressive degree of organization when it comes to buying and storing bottles. Bastian tiers his buys in a three-level wine refrigerator. The third section, 28 bottles, is our keep. The second section is our red, drink now. And the first is for white, before we move them to the kitchen fridge to chill and overflow red. The Cellar Tracker app helps him keep track of the drinking windows of the different wines. Craig Baskin in Chicago would be his polar opposite. Baskin's buying habits are so freewheeling that he often loses track of his wines and then rediscovers them. on a recent foray to Binney's Beverage Depot, the Chicago-based liquor and wine store chain. He bought a number of wines, but neglected to pick up the Albarino he intended to buy. While he was putting his haul away at home, he discovered, happily, that he already had four bottles of it. His mind immediately turned to pairing and another shopping trip. I have to buy some fish to enjoy with the wine. Or Holly Hosier of Kansas City, Kansas, it's easy to keep track of her bottles, which she estimates she generally opens 6 months after purchasing. She keeps them all in a display rack in her finished basement. I'm cognizant that most of the wine should be consumed within 1 year of purchase, so I usually drink the older bottles first, but often get into the temptation to try more recent finds, Hauser said. One such find was a 2022 Paolo Scavino Barbera d'Alba, which she described as full of cherries and well-balanced, without the astringency that some lesser-made Barberos can have. Remember that wine is for drinking. For John Melengott of Centerville, Ohio, when it comes to decisions about the right time to drink wine, the age that matters is his own. Now that he is in his late 70s, if he purchases a great bottle or receives one as a gift, I hurry home, and as soon as it's chilled, we drink it. No sense in tempting fate. Of course, plenty of less than stellar purchases are speedily consumed as well. Gordon Dickinson of Lone Tree, Colorado, shared the story of his visit to Behringer Vineland and Winery in Napa Valley some years ago. Dickinson recalled a fellow visitor asking a tasting room host how long he should wait to open a bottle of Behringer White Zinfandel. The host had a ready answer: about the same time it took you to drive from the wine store to your home. And now, Andy Kessler, there are no rules for success. Young people, are you okay? It's the worst time to be a college graduate in years, reads a recent Newsweek headline. The Federal Reserve warned recent college grads bear brunt of labor market shifts. For 22 to 30-year-old computer science graduates, employment has been failing and falling. Why? Is it ChatGPT, tariffs, late in the economic cycle? No matter, the unwritten social contract for success that's been drilled into your conscience, good grades, decent college, job loyalty, home mortgage, retirement accounts, feels completely broken. It may be time to create your own job. Everyone offers you rules for success. Arnold Schwarzenegger, have a vision and work your ass off. Warren Buffett, successful investing takes time, discipline, and patience. All reasonable, but vague. I prefer J.K. Rowling. I winged it my whole life. I've messed up regularly. There are no rules. Do your thing. Better yet, listen to Thomas Edison. Hell, there ain't no rules around here. We are trying to accomplish something. The world puts you in silos. Author Kyla Scanlon divides Generation Z into safety seekers and digital gamblers. Plausible, except careers that were once safe are now risky. Graphic designers, marketers, some programmers, maybe even lawyers. And surfing the waves of progress to where the world is headed is less risky than you think. Progress comes via surprises, not rules, with inventions no one thought possible. The telescope opened the sky. The microscope illuminated the unseeable, both surprises. So was Edison's movie camera. Quantum theory was heretical until it wasn't. It enabled entire industries, including semiconductors. Gene editing was hard until CRISPR technology simplified it. Machine learning was researched for decades with little result until back propagation allowed voice and facial recognition. And it's been less than 3 years since ChatGPT shocked the world with what it could do. None of these were invented by following the rules, but by coloring outside the lines. Early on, Uber was hit with a cease and desist order. I asked co-founder Travis Kalanick, did you see? No. Did you desist? No. He made his own rules. Take risks. Risk leads to reward. Ignore those who tell you to take calculated risks. It's the magnitude of risk that provides the potential reward. And we need a new name for entrepreneurs. Too French. Maybe risk agents or productivity creators or no rulers. Please, don't embrace mediocrity. Sadly, your public education was dumbed down. 2 years ago, Oregon delayed until 2029 a proficiency requirement in reading, writing, and math for high school graduates. Meanwhile, in the heart of Silicon Valley, the Palo Alto Unified School District delayed stopping grouping students by aptitude, dropping honors English and honors biology. Merit be damned. Why? A biology teacher explained, we know that laning can lead to issues around students' beliefs in themselves. Do not fall into this trap. While your cohorts worry that others aren't validating their feelings, listen to the Terminator and work your back end off to leapfrog them all. Do you need universities? The Financial Times notes that male college graduates have the same jobless rate as those who did not get a college degree. Ouch. More than ever, colleges seem like finishing school, places to mature and get some partying out of your system, plus leave you with crippling six-figure debt and social justice radicalization. So why go? Since 2011, the Thiel Fellowship has paid smart young people $200,000 over 2 years to build new things instead of sitting in a classroom. I asked Peter Thiel how it was going. He pointed to more than 300 fellows who have created $750 billion in value. Smart people with no rules do great things, including Figma's Dylan Field, Anthropic's Chris Ola, Arethium's Vitalik Buterin, Cognition's Walden Yan, and OYO's Ritesh Agarwal. Sure, Harvard can point to Microsoft and Beta worth a combined $5.7 trillion, but Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg dropped out. For now, most students should probably go to college, but rule ignoring is trickling down. Back in July, this column wrote about high agency people using artificial intelligence tools like Replit and Cursor to solve previously difficult problems without becoming experts. This could be you. It's the beginning of the end of credentialism. Corporations better start hiring these high agency, rule-skipping, college-skipping future makers or be left behind. No one knows what's next, not your professors, not futurists, especially not government. You've got the best shot to create the surprise. As Apple fellow Alan Kay said, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. You'll make mistakes. Edison tried to build a spirit phone to talk to the dead. You might even fail. So what? If your brain still functions, you can keep going until you find success that surprises the world. There are no rules. Do your thing. Accomplish something. And now the future of AI lies in monkeys, not microchips. The artificial intelligence boom has all the hallmarks of a gold rush, frenzied investment, sweeping promises, and a race to build ever bigger models. But behind the hype lies a remarkably short-sightedness, one that threatens AI's promise to transform our world. AI systems, including the most powerful large language models, rely on computational force. Despite their apparent sophistication, these models do not understand the world. They merely identify statistical patterns in massive data sets. They cannot form abstract concepts, adapt to unfamiliar environments, or learn from sparse information the way a human toddler can. They function only with enormous hardware, constant access to vast training data, and unsustainable amounts of electrical power. The human brain runs on 20 watts of power, less than a light bulb. Yet it consistently outperforms AI in the forms of intelligence we care most about: abstraction, reasoning, creativity, and social understanding, people skills. To match the computational power of a single human brain, a leading AI system would require the same amount of energy that powers the entire city of Dallas. Let that sink in for a second. One light bulb versus a city of 1.3 million people? Do we even need to calculate how much power would be needed for 1.3 million miles to grasp how unrealistic that would be? These extreme energy and data demands are wasteful and a warning sign. As models swell into the hundreds of billions of parameters, the infrastructure needed to support these scales increase exponentially. The United States does not generate enough electricity to power the growing fleet of data centers behind today's AI. The deeper we dig into this paradigm, the more we run into its bottlenecks: scale, inefficiency, and diminishing returns. We are building machines that are larger, but not smarter. The path to true artificial intelligence, systems that can reason, learn flexibility, and generalize like humans, won't come from stacking more graphic processing units. It will come from a crucial insight. Nature has already solved the problem. The human brain remains the most powerful, adaptable, and efficient computing system on the planet. Thrives with minimal supervision, thrives in uncertain environments, and adapts fluidly across tasks. It is fast, flexible, and energetically frugal. To achieve real AI, we must develop systems that draw not only from the output of the brain, language and behavior, but from its underlying architecture and mechanisms. This means investing in neuroscience research, especially in the study of our closest evolutionary relatives, monkeys and apes. Our simian cousins share our visual systems and, most important, our core brain architecture. They offer the most direct window in how biological circuits give rise to human intelligence because we can study them with a level of experimental precision that is impossible in humans. The first AI models were inspired by research on the visual system of monkeys, but this approach was abandoned in favor of the simpler models at the heart of today's AI. There is already a blueprint that we can follow. More than a decade ago, the United States launched the BRAIN Initiative, an acronym for Brain Research Through Advancing Innovative Neurotechnologies. It is a bold, bipartisan effort to map and understand the neural circuits that drive human thought, emotion, and behavior. That program has been among the most successful scientific endeavors in recent history, yielding transformative tools for observing and manipulating brain activity. It laid the groundwork for understanding how intelligence emerges from biology. We are just at the beginning. What we need now is a second phase, not only to study the brain, but to build from it. We need a national effort to translate the brain's design principles into next-generation intelligent machines. The idea is not new, and other countries are already ahead of us. China is making massive state-backed investments in primate brain research with at least 40 primate breeding centers nationwide, nearly triple the number in the United States. It has built a national infrastructure aimed at decoding the brain and converting that knowledge into strategic technological advances. By contrast, United States research with monkeys is underfunded, vulnerable to political shifts and special interest groups, and increasingly marginalized in favor of unproven alternatives, such as organ-on-chip and engineering-first approaches that cannot replicate the dynamics of a whole brain in a living organism, let alone a human. This is not only a scientific issue. It is a strategic one with profound implications for national security and economic leadership. The country that unlocks the principles of biologic intelligence will shape the next century of technology. Just as the Manhattan Project delivered atomic power and the transistor launched Silicon Valley, the next great leap will belong to the nation that builds machines that learn and think like a human brain, using a fraction of the energy of today's AI. That leap will not come from scaling up semiconductors and data centers. It will come from understanding neural circuits. President Trump's administration is betting our economic future on United States dominance in AI. But the current AI boom, for all its momentum, is nearing the edge of its paradigm. If the United States is serious about creating truly intelligent machines and not merely maximizing capital investments that swell corporate valuations, we must return to biology. The path to real AI does not run solely through Silicon Valley. It runs through laboratories studying real neurons, real circuits, and real cognition in the brains of our primate relatives. To win this race, we cannot rely on engineering shortcuts. We must understand how the computer in each of our heads works. Only then will we be able to build machines that achieve genuine intelligence. And now, a chatbot can be part of your medical team. I was a click away from buying what looked like a government-sanctioned health insurance plan until I pasted the policy into Claude Anthropic's artificial intelligence chat box. In seconds, it warned, "I need to be very direct with you. This is not legitimate insurance. Here are the major red flags." The broker, who had suggested the plan after receiving my data from healthcare.gov, laid down the issue. "No need to worry, it's considered the minimum essential coverage." Claude flagged the discrepancy. Though the policy was pitched as minimum essential coverage, its disclaimers repeatedly stated it is not insurance coverage and does not meet the minimum credentialable coverage requirements. Fortunately, 10 minutes of AI vetting spared me from the dubious plan and its likely cascade of surprise bills. My near miss illustrates how large language model AI systems are helping patients spot errors, understanding lab reports, and stick to care plans. A 2016 Johns Hopkins study estimated that medical mistakes kill 250,000 Americans a year, behind only heart disease and cancer, though some researchers argue that figure runs too high. Either way, much of the checking now falls on patients. AI can shoulder part of the load. In research published back in June, Microsoft Experimental Diagnostic Orchestrator solved New England Journal of Medicine case studies with 85% accuracy, roughly four times as well as primary care docs using the same data. AI models can hallucinate, miscontext, or miscalculate doses. But with the following four tactics, which I tested on my migraines, gut issues, and fatigue, you can enlist AI in your healthcare. Keep a health diary. Open a new AI chat, Claude, ChatGPT, Gemini, Gronk, or other top model, and paste in your health information, diagnoses, surgery, lab results, current medicines and doses, wearable data, and even stubborn mystery symptoms. Privacy is crucial, so before sharing health data, open settings, and in data controls, turn off, use my data to improve the model in Claude, ChatGPT, or Gronk. Gemini does not provide an easy opt-out option. These conversations are not protected by the health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA. Ask the bot what patterns jump out, what's overdue, and which gaps should I address first. Because the model ingests research from every specialty, it connects dots that siloed clinicians may miss, such as a lipid panel blood test not repeated since 2022, or a beta blocker that blunts a migraine drug. The answer is confusing, push back. Explain that in simpler terms and give an example. And list AI analysis. Whatever your health concerns, back pain from red-eye flights, arthritis stiffness on long drive, 3 p.m. brain fog at work, let AI know. Record how you slept, how intense the pain has been, how your mood is holding up. Then ask, spot triggers behind these flare-ups, likely culprits, and offer standard and unconventional fixes. AI might flag skip meals or a hidden medication side effect, or in rare cases, suggest a disorder that doctors miss. Treat AI guidance as a starting point, not a diagnosis. Clarify communications. AI can decode doctor speak. When my gastroenterologist wanted to treat my stomach pain with an anxiety drug, his assistant could not explain why. The chatbot put it plainly. The drug calms overactive gut nerves. When an AI model floats a therapy idea for you, prompt it. Write a concise note to my doctor summarizing the idea, why it could help, any safety flag, and asking for their take. Once you have doctors' opinions in hand, AI can compare them. Paste two specialist notes into the model and ask for a side-by-side table of agreements, disagreements, and citations. Ask your chatbot for a second opinion. Seek counter evidence to any significant AI suggestion by asking, show peer-reviewed studies, especially clinical trials, that argue against this recommendation. Read the abstracts. Bear dense, have the AI summarize key points. Try running your health dilemma through another AI model. If answers diverge, dig deeper. For life-altering decisions and the most advanced AI system, you can use that. Condense the AI system into a short paragraph and run it by your clinician. A 2025 study reduced ChatGPT and Claude diagnostic accuracy by up to 8% simply by adding irrelevant sentences to patients' history, proof that clear facts and a second opinion matter. Before making an important decision, should see a human sign-off. An AI bot is not a physician. It cannot feel a swollen abdomen, order a CT scan, or catch every nuance of family history. Electronic health record systems barely talk to consumer chatbots through Epic, Google, OpenAI, and more than 60 major health systems and tech firms recently pledged to share data as common standards emerge. Food and Drug Administration rules for AI-driven software are inching ahead. Chatbots one day will pull images, physician notes, and prescription histories in real time. Till then, treat today's models like gifted but untested medical school grads. Brilliant, tireless, occasionally overconfident. Put them to work, then double check the big calls. Let's follow this up with something a little different. No one believes your 10,000 steps. People routinely lie about things when they think they can get away with it. They purport to have seen Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock or been in NRG Stadium in Houston the night Tom Brady led the New England Patriots back from a 28-3 halftime to win Super Bowl. Or they say that they briefly attended the Sorbonne or the University of Osaka, secure in the knowledge that no one is likely to investigate their shameless fibs. They say that their brother once had a date with Miley Cyrus, while she was still Hannah Montana, or that Matchbox 20 performed two songs at their son's bar mitzvah. And they always lie about pulling all their money out of the stock market just hours before the epic Wall Street crash back in 2008. I don't mind when people lie about things that can't easily be disproved, but I see it when they lie about things that are obviously not true. Here we come to the issue of the 10,000 steps. I've got to get my 10,000 steps in, people say, often using it as an excuse to leave the table without paying their portion of the check. I'm still 2,000 steps short of my daily quota, they announced before pretending to lumber off for a fictitious walk in the woods. Haven't missed my 10,000 steps in 58 days, they insist, not even when I was on crutches. I know that these people are lying. 10,000 steps works out to roughly 5 miles, and you can tell from the fact that these folks never lose any weight that there is no way they could be walking 5 miles a day. I've been out on a ramble with people who have trouble just getting from the parking lot to the Woodland Trail, who seem completely out of breath before they've covered the first 20 yards. 10,000 steps, go on. Pull the other one. Why do people lie about the mystical 10,000 steps? Probably because they've run out of other things to lie about and feel that something is lacking in their existence. Remember, recreational duplicity is an essential daily human activity without which life would not be possible. Just ask your congressperson. That said, the number of things you can get away with lying about is not infinite. You can't lie about still having hair. You can't get away with saying that you speak Russian. You can't pretend that your dumbass kid went to MIT. And you can only lie about being a fantastic cook if you never invite anybody over to sample your food. And so you lie about your exercise program. I used to think that logging 10,000 steps a day was a uniquely American activity that only my obsessive, insanely competitive countrymen suffered from this particular affliction. But on my last trip to England, people were saying things like, I'd love to chat, but I've got to get in my daily 6,768 meters, or words to that effect. What's more, in each case, I could tell from their huffing and puffing that they were lying. I do not mind my friends lying about walking 10,000 steps a day. If it makes them feel better about themselves, then fine, go ahead and lie. But don't overdo it, because I'm keeping score. And if just one more of my preposterously out of shape friends has the brass to lord it over me and claim to have walked 10,000 steps a day, I'm going to get out my trusty old pedometer and follow him or her on their next phantom jaunt. And then I'm going to call them out as the bald-faced liars that they are. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.